Israel acts unilaterally when dealing with Palestinians, removing Jewish settlements from Gaza unilaterally, no consultation, no negotiation, setting up a siege of Gaza for months, unilaterally depriving Palestinians of the necessities of life, from food to medicine to power to clean water, unilaterally invading and slaughtering Palestinians for the past 3 weeks, now unilaterally declaring a ceasefire. To discuss Israeli unilateralism and the current prospects for the Palestinians in Gaza, we are fortunate to be joined again by Ali Abu Nima in Chicago. Ali is author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, and he's also the co-founder of Electronic Intifada. Welcome again, Ali.
Thank you, Mordecai.
Why did Israel declare its unilateral ceasefire?
Well, because, in short, Hamas had not collapsed. They had hoped that Hamas and the other resistance factions would break and that they would be able to get them to sign up to ceasefire on Israeli terms. They were not able to do that, so they thought it's better to declare a ceasefire with, on our own terms than to agree to one on Hamas's conditions. And, of course, they wanted to be done before Obama took his oath.
So is this a parallel with their 2006 Lebanon invasion and bombing, where they had a certain length of time given them by the Americans and Europeans and couldn't complete their objectives and had to retreat?
Yes, I mean, they didn't really achieve any objectives other than killing and injuring thousands of people and destroying thousands of homes. If you count that as an achievement, as many Israelis do, then that was the only one. But they couldn't stop rocket fire. They didn't break Hamas. And now they, just like with Lebanon, having failed to break the resistance, they're going to the so-called international community, actually the Western powers, to get them to do, to do proxy occupation duty for them. The news comes today that France is sending a frigate to patrol the shores of Gaza on Israel's behalf to try to prevent what Israel calls weapon smuggling. But I think any decent person recognizes that people under blockade and occupation have a right to resist and a right to arm themselves, especially when they are faced with a merciless occupier like Israel. So that we're now back to the same formula after Lebanon, where they try to get the West to do their dirty work of occupation for them. And the West signs up, but of course will not be able to achieve what Israel failed to do itself.
There are calls now for war crimes investigations and trials of Israeli government and military figures. Are these calls coming from a wide variety of sources? Are there new voices raising this demand?
Yes. I mean, I think there's been unprecedented outrage and the mainstreaming, let's say, of the kinds of calls for accountability that were, often excluded before. So you have hundreds of international civil society and juridical organizations calling for war crimes trials. You have UN officials calling for accountability. You have efforts underway already by legal groups and civil society groups in Europe. One in Belgium filed a petition for the arrest of Tzipi Livni when she went there last week, but of course that didn't happen because the laws are stacked to protect government leaders when they're in office. But Israel takes this very, very seriously, and one measure that they took was to tighten the censorship, to impose very strict censorship on Israeli officers' names being published. It's now forbidden to publish the name of any military officer involved in Gaza, or even for them to talk about what they did in Gaza, lest they incriminate themselves. This is what Haaretz is reporting. So Israel takes this very, very seriously, and that, I think, is good news.
The siege on the people of Gaza still largely remains, and there, of course, is an even more desperate need for massive aid and reconstruction. what is happening that's constructive and what is happening that's negative in response to that situation?
Well, what's constructive is that, let's start with what's negative, is that Israel maintains the blockade on Gaza, and that the United States and its allies, just totally unrepentant, are now trying to use aid as a continued weapon against the Palestinians, to say it can't go through Hamas, which is, of course, the elected government, and now the only legitimate Palestinian national movement. They want to keep using it to revive the politically dead Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank. That's the bad news. The good news is that some aid is getting in, not enough. There's been a massive mobilization. There's been a furore over in the UK because in an unprecedented step, the BBC, which I used to have great respect for, refused to broadcast an appeal from the major British charities for Gaza. And, of course, this was a politically motivated under pressure from Israel. So that's good, too, that even the UK government has called on the BBC to broadcast the appeal, and the other channels have done that. So, again, that shows the unprecedented mainstreaming. Another piece of good news is that what I call the Palestinian freedom tunnels are reopening, and Palestinians are breaking the siege, as Jews did during the Warsaw Ghetto, and they are able to bring some supplies in through the freedom tunnels. Of course, what Israel and its allies call smuggling tunnels, but I think we should call them freedom tunnels.
I noticed that Venezuela had sent two plane loads of supplies for the people in Gaza. So there is some hope in these supplies getting through. You mentioned the effort to shore up the politically dead Abbas and his Fatah forces. Obama, after his inauguration speech, made a statement with Hillary Clinton specifically on the situation in Palestine, and it seemed to me to be nothing but a clear declaration of the continuation of Bush policy, unqualified support for Israel, and the effort to coordinate Egyptian and Abbas collaboration with the Israelis. Do you see it differently, or is there more to be understood in that?
No, that's exactly what it was, and it was really embarrassing for the State Department spokesman when he was actually questioned by journalists, you know, does the United States still recognize Abbas as the Palestinian president? And he said, yes. I mean, you can see the exchange on the State Department website. And they say, you know, the journalist says, but on what basis? Because his term expired on January 9th. And, you know, the State Department can't even give a rationale for supporting this person whose term has formally expired, but I think more importantly is repudiated by the vast majority of Palestinians as a collaborator. And, you know, one of the Hamas leaders, Khaled Mishael, made a very powerful speech, which was broadcast, you know, across the Arab world on Al Jazeera, where he said, you know, to the Europeans, look, you may not like us, but we were elected. We, you know, for 3 years you've been trying to overthrow us and you've failed. But think about your own history. Who do you British respect? Do you respect Churchill, who stood up to Hitler and resisted even when London was undergoing the Blitz? Or do you respect Chamberlain, who appeased Hitler? What about the French? Who do you respect? Charles de Gaulle or the Vichy government of Marshal Pétain? And, you know, essentially Palestinians find themselves in the same situation today, but you expect us to support the collaborators. I thought it was a very effective speech, and the Western leaders should really start to pay attention.
Looking at those of us who are working for justice for the Palestinians, what do you see as the current priority organizing tasks to be undertaken?
I think we're at a moment where we published a wonderful article by Haider Aid in Gaza City on electronic intifada called Sharpeville 1960, Gaza 2009. And he says that the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa is what galvanized the world to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that South Africans themselves had called for in 1958, and that Gaza 2009 must be the same kind of landmark. Palestinians have been calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I know that it's already happening in the Canadian trade unions. It's happening on campuses. And this is starting to go mainstream. That's what's incredible. I mean, in the UK, you had Oxford City Council. Of course, everyone, you know, Oxford has great symbolism because of the university voting by a large majority to support boycott, divestment, and sanctions and an arms embargo. This is breaking out in trade unions across Europe, universities. And here's why it's so important. Israel, as a racist state, as an apartheid state, rests on two pillars: military power and support from the West. Well, military power was shown to be absolutely useless in breaking the resistance and the will of people struggling for freedom and justice. And now Western support, the narrative that Israel is this righteous creation in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust, is just crumbling as people see the true nature of the regime there. And so that's where people have to put their efforts: boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It's right, it's moral, it's nonviolent resistance, it's what Palestinians are asking for, and it can be effective, I believe, in a relatively short period of time.
I was noticing yesterday received an email from Sweden that the Stockholm City Council, Community Council, had awarded a $7 billion project. There were two competing companies, one French company that also is involved in transport construction in the settlements, connecting them with Jerusalem. And there was a campaign in Sweden against awarding the contract to that company, and the Swedish Community Council responded to that campaign and awarded it to the competitor who was not violating international humanitarian law. So that's an encouraging sign of what you're just saying.
It's exactly, and that shows it is possible. It often seems like these big corporations are just so daunting that the, you know, multi-billion dollar contracts involved are too lucrative. And this shows that, you know, people power does matter, and sometimes these campaigns take time, but they can really succeed. And to be honest, in the past few weeks, it's been hard to keep up with the number of such pieces of good news. It's, you know, even in the United States, which is, you know, decades behind in terms of public understanding of this issue, you had 900 academics, many of them mainstream, signing a very strong statement in support of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I've never seen anything like that in the United States. And even here, you know, the sort of blanket Israeli propaganda has not succeeded in silencing the kind of reality from coming out of what's happened on the ground in Gaza. So these are the things that, you know, we have to build on this. We can't just say, okay, the shooting is over, now we can relax. No, this is the moment to step up our efforts for justice and not to relent. I think that the next year, the next couple of years are going to be absolutely decisive.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll end on that positive note and use it to stimulate our own organizing efforts. Thank you again, Ali.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Ali Abu Nima. He's author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, and he's co-founder of Electronic Intifada, the outstanding English language source of information on situations in Palestine.